Let's do it.
Go live.
Are we live? I think we're live. Good evening, Dungeon Masters. It is evening, right? Yeah, there's a fireplace. It's evening. Good evening, Dungeon Masters. I'm Baron Drop. I am joined by Kelsey Dionne of the Arcane Library.
Hello.
In fact, I'm not joined. I'm joining her.
Yes.
I'm in her house right now.
He got into my house and I let him stay for a minute.
So, I don't know what we're getting into today. We're going to talk about how Kelsey dissected and analyzed and thought through all kinds of different games in order to make Shadow Dark what it is today. Kelsey, thanks for jumping on my channel with me.
Thanks for doing this.
And letting me into your house. This is so fun.
I decided to answer the door after all. No. This is fun. I decided to wear a blazer because someone's not wearing his.
Yeah, but someone is also not providing Shadow Dark or Stingbat plushies.
I know, I need to do that. That's so. On the docket. So eventually. Oh my gosh. Well, yeah, this is the first like post Kickstarter. Like the Kickstarter is pretty much done. So
yeah.
This is my first discussion after it's truly what I would call complete now. So it's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how was the Kickstarter?
It was the most eventful year of my life, probably.
Right?
Yeah, very life-changing.
Can you estimate how many emails you have received from various backers?
Like, in the last 2 weeks, like probably 600.
Awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess it's mostly good stuff, right?
Or is it
you know, there was a problem with shipping?
It's probably a little more towards the there's a problem with shipping side, but that's kind of to be expected.
Yeah,
so,
yeah,
but a lot of really nice emails, too, honestly, just really nice messages. And I mean, if we're counting messages, Kickstarter messages and emails and like comments, it's like well over 1,000 in the last couple of weeks. So it's been wild. Yeah.
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 That's cool.
Oh, man.
Okay. So let's talk about Shadow Dark.
Yes.
Before we talk about Shadow Dark, I'm running another fundraiser for my favorite charity, Develop Africa. They send money for school supplies to developing cities and developing communities in West Africa. And they also started doing microloans, which sounds like $50. Sounds really silly and seems odd for a charity to do that. They're zero interest though. But the idea is that you just give a family like $50 and that gets them into a position where they can afford like one tool that's stopping them from being able to provide for their family in what we would perceive as, you know, a very menial job. But in Africa, this might be a comfortable working class profession, like making charcoal, but you need a chainsaw to do that. So anyway, if you can donate money to Develop Africa, that'd be awesome. And I don't know, maybe I'll do a feat of strength for every $100 worth of money we raise. I don't know what that looks like.
He'll show you how tall he is in real life, which is very tall.
I'm not that tall.
I mean, you're tall. I was like, hello?
I'm not like Taryn Pounds Indestructo Boy, who's like 6'13" or something.
Taryn is two people standing on their shoulders together.
Yeah, he's riding four goblins.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. But Develop Africa is a super worthy cause. We raised for it before.
Yeah,
and it's very satisfying to know that the amount that we raise it really makes a genuine impact in people's lives. It's not just like, this is enough to buy like, you know, two things for one family. It's a lot for them. Yeah.
No, it's a big deal. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like $1 is 10 pencils.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Think about that. How many? And this is some of these communities just don't have access to supply chains to get pencils. There is no Walmart.
So here we are. But, well, okay.
Shadow Dark. Let's talk about it.
Let's
do the thing. How did you go about deciding that Shadow Dark needed to exist? Let's start there. Why is Shadow Dark? Why was it a shower thought?
Yeah, okay. So I at first didn't want to write it because I was like, I can't do that. Like, first of all, it's a bit silly. I think that a lot of game designers eventually write their own system whether or not they intend to publish it, and it's kind of like a rite of passage. And so I was like, oh my God, this is happening to me. Oh no, I'm an adventure writer. I don't want to write a system. So I spent a lot of time searching around for what I wanted to adopt as my sort of like old school style or like exploration style focused system, because I wanted to write some adventures in that vein. And I'm just too picky. I hunted around and I ended up just not being ready to fully adopt certain systems that I found because I had some philosophical things that I wanted to implement that I would have had to really house rule a lot, like enough that it would have been cumbersome. And so then I started to be like, oh no, now I'm gonna have to write my own, aren't I, to address all these things. And it started to grow out of that notion, you know, that I really wanted to do something super custom for the gameplay style that I wanted. And it was like kind of my thesis statement on old school gaming. That's cool. My own thesis statement on it.
So what would you say, and I'm sure like we all have an idea of like some of the larger inspirations, but you know, there might be some shockers in there. What would you say when you were shopping around and deciding that you would have to like heavily homebrew specific systems to staple onto other systems in order to get it to do what you wanted? What were some of the standout systems that you were looking at as you were like decomposing, recomposing in that process?
There were three that I was almost going to try to adapt for these adventure writing projects, and because they're all three very great systems, I love them all. The first one was ICRPG, which is probably Shadow Dark's closest brother, and there's a lot of cross-pollination between both games, and Hank over at Runehammer has been probably my greatest game design Jedi Yoda master in the industry. And so there's a ton of cross-pollination there. And I love and play a ton of index card RPGs still, but I was like, well, I wanted to make something that leaned a little bit more into the classic dungeon crawler feel, and Hank purposely did not design ICRPG to do that. It's a much more scene-based, like dynamic, semi-like combat-focused thing, and any game has role-playing potential outside of that, so that wasn't a thing, but it was more like the way that you go about exploring a space. I wanted to bring in some classic D&D methods for that. I also looked at Five Torches Deep.
Okay.
Because it was kind of like the flagship 5e old school crossover, and it's really cool. It has a lot of phenomenal ideas for modernizing old school gaming in it. But I ended up having a few things that I would have changed. Actually, so many things that I would have changed, especially about like spell casting and character progression, that I ended up being like, I'm going to have to go my own way on this. And then Dungeon Crawl Classics, which...
Ooh, what did you pull from Dungeon Crawl Classics specifically?
I loved the roll-to-cast system.
Okay.
Which I want to say that DCC did that first formally, but a lot of other systems have adopted it since then. Like Index Card RPG has roll-to-cast, and plenty of other systems do. But I also, I think maybe the free-spirited sort of embracing of the old school and the sword and sorcery and the zany really was, like, DCC was a game that showed me, like, you can pick a vibe and lean into it and enjoy it. And, like, that was actually something that I really took from DCC, was the willingness to adopt a vibe in a sort of unapologetic, like, sword and sorcery, like, high adventure, like... You know, like a tone, like choosing a tone for the game and sticking with
right.
it. Mm-hmm.
So it made the vibe check, everybody.
Yeah, pass the vibe test. My wife said, my wife doesn't know how to play D&D hardly at all, so she'll be like, "Hey, I heard you were playing. I heard you failed your vibe check." She's gonna write her own game someday.
One day.
Mm-hmm.
One day.
Mm-hmm.
So, what system, or like, can you talk more about like? What systems and ideas that you saw that you definitely pulled into Shadow Dark from those games?
Yeah.
Like if those games were not, if those games weren't sufficient to do the kind of game that you wanted to play and wanted to express at your table, what got cobbled together from those games into Shadow Dark?
Yeah, one of the big things that made its way into Shadow Dark was sort of the modernizing philosophy of games like ICRPG, where you threw an enormous amount of at-the-table gameplay, which is what Hank did to develop ICRPG. He began to notice ways to make gameplay faster and more efficient, ways to make sort of the sticking points of D&D that we all kind of didn't realize we hated a little bit more efficient, like slightly more abstracted movement is a huge innovation. I think, does Karen do that too?
Karen does it, yeah.
Yeah, and I think the Black Hack does that too. Yes. And like, that's a huge innovation in my opinion.
Okay.
It completely reduces the pain points of measurement that I feel when I'm running. And so I first encountered that in ICRPG and I was like, this is like really cool. Simplified reliance on skill checks, or not relying on skill checks at all, really, just reducing that down to ability scores. I feel like that's a good direction that game design was moving, because we reached this huge high point of like super skill proliferation in third edition and like Pathfinder. Yeah. And it was like maximal. It was as much as it could be. And then it's been condensed down over time throughout the editions of D&D. And I think the third party indie sphere has also been moving in that direction because it makes more sense. It's actually more freeing. So the games that I was admiring really had very like low complexity skill systems. And I was like, this is a really useful thing for freeing up player autonomy. You know, it's like, here's not a menu of things you can do, but rather you can do whatever you can imagine. So that was from ICRPG 2, and to a certain extent, I think DCC.
Okay.
Not really a skill system in there, if I can recall.
Cool.
Gosh, what else? Making sure that action economy doesn't get bogged down, right? That's like a more modern thing too, and you're seeing that across some of the games that I was particularly inspired by, like, you do like one action or maybe two at the most on your turn, and it speeds up gameplay.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So a lot of those things were like percolating up through the design space at large. So like it's so funny. I don't think I've ever, some people have said that I've claimed that Shadow Dark is like revolutionary, and I've never claimed that. I think that it's maybe a distillation, but it's really not a lot of new stuff.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it very clearly synthesized what, like in a 5e adjacent language, what the OSR was about or what old school gaming looked like and represented that in the best possible way to modern audiences, basically.
That's what I was hoping to do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, really, it very much looks like that.
And there are a lot of decisions made because of nostalgia about D&D. Like, one way that I diverted away from other games that surrounded me was I kept derived 3d6 stats because to me that is so essential to the experience of D&D and the memories I have of it. 3d6 down the line.
Exactly. Go get Bob World Builder shirt.
Yes, Rooney Armor designed this. This is Bob World Builder shirt. I had to have it because I agree. I think that it's so baked in to our experience of D&D, and I wanted to have the nostalgia. I wanted to have a connection to D&D in this game. It was pretty overt. So. And a few things like that stayed in Shadow Dark because of not the game itself, but the meta of the game, the experience of the game. I wanted it to align. Right. So, yeah, stuff like that. I don't know.
Okay.
What else should we dissect?
I don't know. So I guess like thinking about it like this, like did you have like a process that you want to talk about more clearly, like for somebody who is, they have their own home game. And maybe Shadow Dark isn't the thing that they want to play, which is obviously entirely possible.
Mm-hmm.
What would you say is retrospectively looking back, what did your process contribute to the creation of Shadow Dark? And now that Shadow Dark is complete, did anything find its way into initial drafts of Shadow Dark that you realize now, if you had done more work at the beginning, like what you could have stopped from getting into initial drafts?
Oh yeah, because I went down some design rabbit holes with it that ended up getting tested out of the game. I mean, the most obvious one being a skill system. I had a skill system in Shadow Dark.
Oh, wow.
I did, and I fought with it for so long, and I was like, it's not working. It's not, it's, I had it because I thought I needed it to be adjacent to Dungeons & Dragons.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just was like, but we didn't have skill systems way back in the day, pre-2E. And I, you know, I had to remind myself that worked back then. That worked very well. And so a little bit of faith there and removing that system. Because it didn't play well at the table. And that's the biggest thing. Kind of going back to the first part of your question, I think that if you want to sit down and start to design your own game, it has to come from at the table experience. So I think. You need to be playing different kinds of games, multiple game styles, and taking note of what's out there and trying it so that you can discover what you do and don't like. Like discovering points of friction or issues is actually really important. Like things that you don't like about the system you're playing helps you design something in a way that you do like. And we were talking about this the other day where it's almost like you examining the systems that are close to what you want to do helps you lift out things that you might want to change. And that really was kind of the core of where I got started with Shadow Dark. I realized I wanted to make too many changes. And So, of course, it's a blend of what you like, but knowing what you don't want in your game is as essential.
Right.
Yeah. And then as you're doing that process, you're making a list of things that you do and don't want, you have to try to distill what you want down into some pillars, like some core pillars. And I ended up sharing that in the Shadow Dark book, the core ethos page of the book, which was the design pillars that I was writing the game around. And
just for the viewers, what mm-hmm. what exactly do you mean by pillars if you don't have the book in front of you?
Yes. So
like what are these pillars?
Yes, they're kind of high concept items that are going to have a waterfall effect down into the way that you design systems. They're not systems. They're ideas. So one of the examples of this is darkness must matter. That was one of the core pillars of Shadow Dark Design. Time must matter. So before you even get down to designing the mechanics, like, you have to identify what you want the mechanics to actually reflect. Because if you're just making mechanics for the sake of it, it's just sort of an exercise in what you can do, not what you should do. And making a list of, like, I really want darkness to matter. I really want, for example, one could say I really want tactical combat to matter. I really want movement to matter. I really want, role-playing to matter, as broad as that is. And then you can move in the direction of those goals. And you don't want too big of a list, but you want one that covers kind of all the broad aspects of what you think you might be designing.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Did you have any of these ethos that changed over time or that were like you recognized that some were in conflict with each other?
Yes. I recognized that some of them were in conflict with each other because I was designing away from them in ways like wanting to insert a skill system. When I was doing that, I was actually like moving away from some of my core ethos around wanting player freedom to be super important. And so it helped me realize that, like, knowing the design pillar I wanted that I was actually working against. And I had to really step back and be like, why am I trying to design a skill system into here? Is it because I'm afraid people won't take the game seriously if it doesn't have one? Are people going to call it too arbitrary if I don't have one? And I had to really examine that, and I ended up stripping a few things out that conflicted with those pillars.
What did you remove besides the skill system?
I also removed a lot of, this is a silly one, but a lot of inventory that was unnecessary. Classic gear that was on the D&D list of essential gear. One of the things was that gear must matter. That was one of the pieces of core ethos I had. And I was designing a bunch of gear that didn't have any purpose, like hammers. Why
was that intentional to remove hammers?
Yes, hammers were in an early draft of Shadow Dark, and they it turns out that iron spikes and pitons are very useful to adventurers and very great for like problem solving and things like that.
But how do you hammer them in?
I know. Well, I had to abstract that. I ended up abstracting it because what happened was inventory is so limited, your gear slots are so limited in Shadow Dark that they each matter. Yeah, and then a hammer was a useless piece of gear that you had to use to make an actually useful piece of gear matter. Mm. And so it was dead weight. And
that's interesting. I never noticed that. Like, I've even played Shadow Dark now where players have pulled out iron spikes and they say they put it in a rock joiner, a mortar line.
Yeah.
And I never even was like, okay, what are you using to hammer it in? It's never even, I never even thought about it.
I know, because you can come up with, I know it is, and this is an example of an abstraction that does, it doesn't go with reality's demands as well, but identifying places where you can abstract out simulationism or like making it seem like the real world for the sake of a better play experience, those are like the fussy things you do when you're playing your game at the table and you're building dozens of characters to play test the process. I'm just like, well, you probably just use the back of another iron spike to hammer that one in, or like the pommel of your longsword. I don't know, like, come up with something, use a rock. So
yeah, use a rock. Yeah. Exactly.
And that is why hammers were removed. I see everyone saying never forget 11/12/21, the day hammers were removed from the beta draft.
I love that you have fans that remember when this was removed. I didn't even know this was a thing.
It's Doc. Doc is the mod in our Discord server. He's one of the two mods, and he remembers that day well.
That's so funny.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So.
So, chat, do you have any questions about Shadow Dark or just game design in general that you want to pose to us? It looks like we have probably like a 30-second lag or so.
I know.
So we'll just continue to riff about Shadow Dark or game design. I guess, what RPGs, while we're waiting on this is something that I think is really curious. What RPGs that are not D&D are your favorite? Like, not D&D related at all. No at OSR, all. No TSR, no WotC, no nothing.
It can't have skeletons in it.
It can't have skeletons
That's
in
the barometer for is it D&D.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay. So I can't say the skeletons, actually, which I really love. It's a fun game. But I really like Dread. And I know that's an old, it's a deep cut. But because that's the first game I played where there was like a really visible meta currency, the Jenga Tower. And it opened up this entire realm of like, oh my God, I suddenly realized that we are not our characters. We are the audience to our characters. And
ooh, that's such a good way to say that.
Yeah.
You're the audience to our characters.
Yeah, and that you can play with the emotions and experience of the players on a separate plane from that of the characters. And that revelation eventually led to the Torch Timer in Shadow Dark. So, yeah.
Okay, hold on. Okay, so if we're talking about the metagame, like, relationship of players at the table, and, like, one player just decides they're going to be a jackass and make a check in Dread that they know they shouldn't be making because they're, like, two bricks away from the tower clearly going to fall, how does that translate to... Is it because... You know, how do you go from that to the hour-based torch mechanic?
Well, because I guess both the interesting thing about a metacurrency is that the players can influence it, like, for bad reasons. You know,
okay.
They can mess with it. And it's like, if you want to try to knock the tower over in Dread, everyone else who's playing is like, no. And you're engaging with the game in sort of a weird way,
right.
A fun way. And that's true with the Torch Timer, too. Like, someone can purposefully waste time and run the Torch Timer down. And that might actually even introduce an interesting level of like antagonism that someone could subtly do, like if they're an enemy.
I never realized that this is a possibility.
Yeah.
I don't know why.
Yeah.
But it's never come up in my games.
I don't think I think I have had someone intentionally run down the timer for like antagonistic reasons that were kind of funny and at a con but like if you're playing the character, because you know the classic, like I'm actually playing a character that for the next six sessions you guys don't realize is a doppelganger or something,
right?
You can antagonize the players.
Oh, that's so good.
And it's almost like the werewolf level of like, I'm gonna try to hide the fact that I am abusing the meta currency and see how long I can get away with it,
right?
So I think that's so fun.
So good. Okay, so besides Dread, do you have any other standout favorites?
I played so much D&D and D&D adjacent stuff as a kid that it's definitely my bread and butter. I used to play the Dragon Ball Z role-playing game that came out like 15 years ago. Oh,
was this
D20
based?
No, was like, I think it was a dice pool system.
Okay. Usually those kinds of games are.
Yeah, and it kind of soured me on dice pool systems because it was so easy to just ridiculously break the game in like one session. I was like a first level Z warrior, and I was like, oh, I already figured out a way to make a Kamehameha that can blow up the moon.
Okay.
Yeah. So it was.
But West End Star Wars doesn't redeem it.
I didn't play a ton of that.
Oh,
I only played a little bit of
it. We're done. I'm leaving your house now.
I know. One of my friends actually worked on designing, I believe it was like the third edition version, like the D20 version of Star Wars, or was it?
Oh, yeah, there was a D20 third edition version.
And I did play it.
It was awful. I owned it.
Played
it was
it
bad.
Twice.
Do not get it.
I think it had a lot of, it suffered from third edition's bonus creep problems.
Yes,
you know?
Absolutely.
But at least you could be like, well, I am a first level Jedi who can lift an X-Wing, you know? So.
Okay.
It was so fun. So fun. What about, okay, so you have played a vast array of games, and you
sort of.
Well, you have.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah. There. Okay, I own a lot of dust collectors, and I got tired of them being dust collectors. And I had a group that, like, in between longer campaigns, we just spent like a year doing like one shots or two shots in all the systems that I actually wanted to try, and learned. Really, I think it was more of an experience of learning how to read the rules because I perceived the rules as good, but would the gameplay at the table represent what I initially thought of the rules on a cold read? And it made me far better at analyzing rules after that experience to just do a year of one-shots, basically.
Interesting. Do you remember any specific really crazy revelations where, like, this seemed awesome and it totally sucked or vice versa?
Yeah, GURPS. Oh. I thought GURPS was going to be awesome.
Isn't that, like, the age-old internet, like, but what about GURPS? Yeah, you know, yeah. Like, everywhere. No, like,
I thought GURPS was going to be awesome, and it was the most time-consuming, table-heavy. Mm. Like, it was worse than Rollmaster. I can't even begin to describe, like, not only that, but, like, it seemed as if in GURPS, and it didn't initially jump out to me, it seemed as if that there were two different versions of resolving issues in the game that were like, okay, so what happens if you're making a perception check and I'm making a stealth check and we both succeed?
Like, yeah, that's bad.
It was really weird. Like, that was just not... It for me, at least, it did not jump out at me in the rules. Of course, this was like a decade ago.
Right.
So, you know, that GURPS was probably the most gut-wrenching standout of, I thought it was going to be awesome. It absolutely was not.
What a bummer. But yeah. This just, I guess it illustrates the importance of, like designing from as a result of play.
Yeah,
like,
no, absolutely.
That's even how I write adventures. Like, half the reason I changed the format that I write 5th edition adventures in arose completely out of my inability to sit down and read, like, a 2nd edition style info dump style adventure.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, and I was just like, I either have to quit playing D&D or I have to do something about this. And you know what I chose.
Yeah, absolutely. Another one that jumps out at me was I actually found Western Star Wars in a really backwards way.
Mm-hmm.
My friends were really into Mass Effect.
Oh.
And there is a, like, unofficial D6 pool style, like, built on top of the West End Games engine version of Mass Effect, the RPG, basically.
Okay.
So I just found that and started, like, playing through it. And I was like, okay, this looks all right. We'll play it. And we had a blast playing, like, you know, some sort of covert mission type of thing. And, like, that was awesome. But then, like, I went back and started reading the Star Wars RPG. And I was like, why? This just feels like the force effects feel really clunky. The combat felt really clunky when I was reading it. And then we sat down to play, and it took us about 2 rounds of getting through the initiative to, like, one or 2 rounds of combat to really get our heads around what was going on, because it was pretty different to have, like, this, like, you had initiative within initiative in West End D6,
okay,
which was really interesting. Everybody took an action, and then you could declare that you wanted to take more actions at the beginning of the combat round for a penalty.
Oh.
So, and it just seemed so clunky and weird to me. But we realized all you had to do was put a big old, you know, D6 die. Like, that's how many actions I have left this combat turn.
Oh.
And it made, like, you know, on a D&D scale, it doesn't really make sense. But, like, you could hypothetically say, I want to take 12 actions and just blast the crap out of the stormtrooper. The stormtrooper's only got enough dice pool potential to shoot back at you once. And you're just going to unload an entire blaster clip into him. And getting through 2 rounds of combat showed me just how elegant you can make a tactical combat game and still keep the game moving lightning fast. Because every character only has one action within that round of initiative before it comes back to their initiative again, where they can take their future actions.
Ah.
So, like, it does this really interesting thing of threading the needle between, you know, typically like a more modern or contemporary OSR game, especially like Index Card RPG, you get a move and an action and that's all you get.
Mm-hmm.
Or like Pathfinder, where you have a bonus action, a swift action, a free action, an action, and double action. Like, how many frickin', you know, I'm being pedantic here, but like, how many things do you do on your turn? Meanwhile, the rest of the table is snoring.
Yeah.
West End D6 just is like, yeah, do whatever the heck you want, but you're only allowed to do one part of it on your turn before it comes back around to you. Absolutely fantastic stuff.
Super interesting. That's actually, I would love to look back into that.
And yeah. We should play West End Star Wars.
Yeah, we should. I want to play it. Let's play it. Let's get Alex in on it. I know he played it too. I had seen someone in the chat ask a question that, and thank you for putting all capitals in it because I saw it. It jumped out. But someone asked about the die drop tables in Shadowdark for creating dungeons and how it's limited to like 5 to 10 rooms or so. And that is correct, but if you want to make a larger dungeon, just treat each part of the dungeon as a separate node that recycles the die drop method.
Oh, that yeah, that's fun.
Yeah, just do that. Just use it again. Make a bigger dungeon and stick them together.
Yeah, one of my greatest hacks when I want to make a larger dungeon is make a 5 5-room dungeon.
Oh, yeah.
Make 5 5-room dungeons and smash them together.
That would be really interesting because... Yeah. That actually would be because it's like... The 5-room dungeon, I think, is a very like 5th edition oriented design style, and mm-hmm. I don't think it works very well for old school games. But if you blend a bunch of them into a larger space, it requires some exploration and mm-hmm. taps into the mechanics that draw out resources through exploration, then that would be really interesting and cool. And each themed in its own way.
Yeah, and not just that, but like interconnected themes in another way.
Yeah.
Like something that gets really damn noodly that I thought about doing was like, if each dungeon also represents in its totality kind of the meta conception of each of one room in a 5-room dungeon.
Yeah, so like this is so the you know, climactic battle within the you should totally do that. Yeah. Would it be possible?
I've got maps of one dungeon that I've done this with.
Yeah.
I just am frustrated with myself and need to publish it.
Just publish it.
I know. I need to make stuff.
I know. Sometimes it's scary to publish something that's conceptual. Like, I've definitely put some work out there where I'm like, I was trying something new and weird in this, and I'm not sure if anyone's going to notice, and if they do, they might hate it. So it's like a little bit scary. It's easy to stick to the formulas that you know work. And in fact, you probably, like, if you have a formula that works, definitely use it repeatedly. But mm-hmm. yeah, it can be kind of scary to put something out there that's conceptual.
It's more like I'd have to actually write it. Like, I have to put... Because right now it's just like scrawl on notebook paper
mm-hmm.
and taking it to a polished enough state to, you know, be able to sell it for $4.99.
You can do it. You can do it. You did the hard part already if it's conceptual.
I guess so.
I saw a question where someone said, did you consider Roll Under when designing Shadowdark? And that is the reason why I did not choose Black Hack as my game of choice. I think the Roll Under, for me it was, a core pillar that we needed a unified system. Because we needed Roll High to always be better in Shadowdark. And that is true throughout the entire game, including Game Master facing roles. So I couldn't do Roll Under because I think it flies in the face of like, well, this is the one exception to that rule and it's a very big exception. And so I couldn't bring myself to do it.
That's funny.
And I just like rolling high. I guess like I grew up in the post 2E, like I played second edition and then third edition came and steamrolled it a few years after I started playing. And rolling a natural 20 on a D20 is so ingrained in D&D and D&D adjacent players that like I cannot have a 20 be a failure, you know, at least in my own work. It can work in other games and it does. It works in Black Hack. It works in Crown and Skull actually. It's like... Other games do leverage that well, but they didn't work with Shadowdark's philosophy of having everything be aimed at roll high so we could have a unified mechanic for simplicity's sake.
That makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Do we have any other questions in the chat? So we're having to like read my laptop from all the way over here, and it's really far away.
I know.
So maybe I wish we could have just dragged it closer, but then it'd be in the video.
I know. It says, please answer the question from Mika Brush, but it scrolled past me before I could catch it. So please ask it again.
Please ask. Where's my phone? I'm going to grab my phone.
Okay. He's grabbing
the phone. Actually, scroll the images. Scroll the...
Let's see. I'm seeing a question of, are you considering revamping any of your previous work?
Porting your 5e work over to Shadowdark? That'd be cool.
It would be. I've had people very kindly ask me about that. And I designed it using 5th edition design ethos, and I don't think it would port well to Shadowdark, genuinely. And that's not a dig on 5th edition. I love designing for 5th edition. So I just think that when I was designing that material for 5th edition, I was using a methodology that was trying to leverage what 5th edition does best, and that's not necessarily what Shattered Arc does best. So it could fall flat, you know? And the other part of it too is I almost feel like I would rather make new stuff for Shattered Arc than to retread stuff that I made that wouldn't really be an idealized output for the game. You know, like I'd rather make a new adventure that was for Shadow Dark than try to convert five that were not for it and landed a bit mediocre because of that, you know? So, yeah, that was...
Jeff Soz looks like he's playing question curator role.
Thank you!
We have, from the DM's craft, is your game design more intellectual or more just gut feeling?
Ooh, it's totally gut feeling at first because it has to pass a smell check at the table.
Okay.
You know, like, whatever the mechanic is, if it doesn't feel like it works in actual table play, then it's not working, you know? And so intellectually, I don't think that Shadow Dark has any what I would call like virtuoso design. There's nothing that's so intellectually like a moonshot that it's like groundbreaking. So I think that really it is much more of a gut vibe type game.
That's interesting.
Yeah. I do think that Torch stuff was...
Yeah, I was going to say, the Torch stuff seemed really novel.
Yeah,
like everyone's tying it to an actual clock.
I know, and surely I'm not the first person... I know I'm not the first person probably to make a real-time mechanic in games, but I was kind of developing this game in a vacuum, too, at a certain point, and like the Torch timer thing, I hadn't seen anywhere else, and it solved a problem that I had, and it really came from my understanding of other games that have meta currencies, but I had never seen one like that, so that's... and. Also from being a teacher and timing students to get them to act more quickly and stop wasting the dang time during class. That's literally partly where it came from.
That's funny.
Yeah. But, oh, is there... Okay. I'm looking over at our screen.
You focused on making darkness core to the game. Where and how do you feel what that did will...
Wait, to scroll it up. Should I scroll it up?
Yeah. What that did to city, wilderness, and other non-dungeon crawl related stuff.
What, how do you feel that did about city? Oh, okay. Do I have to click this arrow?
Yeah, you gotta scroll all the way to the bottom now. Or click the arrow. The wrong way. There we go.
Okay, you have inverted scrolling.
Sorry.
No worries. Okay, so how does darkness impact the overland portion? It really separates the mythic underworld from the overworld a lot. And like the concept of the mythic underworld is this idea that when you enter a dungeon or any place that would be considered the Shadow Dark, so like essentially when you go into dungeon crawling rules, it is suddenly much more dangerous in the real world. And that's you're trying to create a little bit of a balance between the mundane and normal and the safe versus the dangerous and the unexpected and the nonsensical. And so overland travel is still dangerous in Shadow Dark, and hex crawling is still really dangerous, but the real timer in hex crawling is rations.
Mm.
You're probably not going to be traveling at night unless you're foolish or desperate. And there's still danger level is still present when you're doing overland travel, but it's a different style of gameplay that I didn't want to be the same as dungeon crawling. So light mechanics aren't as prevalent in overland travel. But you still can die from starvation very easily. So it's not like it's safe.
Right.
I hope I answered that question thoroughly. But they're very different modes of gameplay in the rules. But I think it is another thing I hear is that people are like, well, Shadow Dark is only about dungeon crawling. And it has the most robust rules around dungeon crawling. But I don't feel that role-playing rules need to be super robust. And I don't think that overland rules need to be super complicated if you have a hex crawling system. So... whereas dungeon crawling needed more systematized complexity. So, yeah. You can still roleplay.
Yeah, you can.
You can still have campaigns. You can still talk to people. You can still go out in the wilderness. Like, that's the same as in Basic Expert. The rules were pretty, you know, they weren't super heavy-handed. But people still did all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Do we have any other questions?
How do you balance mechanics for a non-heroic fantasy system without it feeling like the game is punishing the players? That's a good question. Instead of focusing on how you don't want to penalize the players for making good decisions, so you have to give them the power to make good decisions. Like, I think that just by being heroic means that you're allowed to be a little bit more foolish in your actions. because you have a buffer, you have a safety buffer. Like, I can spend the points I need to get myself out of the situation. Oh, I have enough HP to absorb a few mistakes. So you reward players for being smart, and you don't encourage them to be foolish. And so I'm not sure that, like, having a more dangerous system would be called more punishing. I think that it's a little bit more trusting in the players to play smart, and then you reward that smart play. So, yeah, it's interesting. Mm-hmm. Did I just contradict myself a little bit?
I don't know. I think you've threaded the needle there.
Yeah, like, it's funny because I don't like making mechanics that are punitive. If you, like, look very carefully at the game, you'll see that a lot of stuff does not have a punitive downshot if you fail, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Except in a couple, like, minor cases. So try not to be arbitrarily punitive. Like, haha, you failed your attack roll, therefore you must make a fumble check. Like, no.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. Like, don't work that kind of stuff into the game, and then trust that the people playing the game will play smart and then reward playing smart.
So there's another good question that we've scrolled past. I don't know, remember who asked it.
Mm-hmm.
How do you know when something isn't working at the table and it's just not... Like, what's the difference between knowing that it doesn't fit and it's not your or that it's not your personal preference, or like, are those two things the same?
They often are, because I think if you're working on a system, you have to be writing it for yourself first and foremost, because you have to like it. Like, don't write stuff that you don't like because you think someone else does. The only real barometer you have is whether you like it. So you have to work on building up your ability to detect what you do and don't like in games, which is why you have to play a lot of games and play games that you think suck, so that you can discover why, you know, and identify why, and identify the feeling of at the table, like, I'm bored, I'm not enjoying this, my character feels powerless, my character feels like XYZ. If you've never experienced that, or you've never played another game that gives you a different reflection on that experience, you can't really identify what you don't like. So, yeah, I lost the thread of where I was going, but how do you identify whether something's not working at the table or whether it's just that you don't like it? Those are the same thing.
That is a good point.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this is another good question here. What about this narrative that keeps popping up apparently? I've never seen it.
Which is it?
But House DM says that people say Shadow Dark doesn't work for long-term styles of campaigns. Can you speak to that at all?
I've been running the same group in it for years. They're fifth level. And yeah. I at least in my experience, there's been absolutely no hindrance to running campaign style play. I think it's because people see that it cuts off at 10th level, and they speculate that that means that the game is supposed to be shorter in duration.
Mm-hmm.
Or possibly that the lethality of the game might hinder campaign play. But it's weird because Basic Expert, which is another close cousin of Shadow Dark, was much more lethal than Shadow Dark.
Oh, for sure.
Yet.
100%.
Right. And yet we got amazing adventures like Keep on the Borderlands that inspired years of play for some people. Just that adventure alone. And the Caves of Chaos, enormous amount of gameplay potential just in that. And characters were dying a lot more frequently back then. So I think that, you know, to a certain extent, people like to equate the lethality of the game with its inability to handle campaign play, but history has kind of proven that to be not true. And my own experience playtesting the game has allowed me to run very lengthy campaigns in it.
I remember I started a Shadow Dark campaign that was kind of on again, off again, but we played for almost a year and a half back before the full rules were even released.
Oh, yeah.
Because I bought a whole crap ton of Shadow Dark to give away as wedding favors.
That's how we met.
We met. I was like, can you help me with wedding favors? I want to give away an RPG, and yours is the one to do it with.
So cool.
Yeah. But it was a Conan the Barbarian themed wedding, too.
Oh.
But no, like, ever since then, I had been playing a Shadow Dark campaign, and we've been playing for almost a year and a half, almost two, maybe close to 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
But it's been kind of on again, off again. Probably a year's worth of gameplay. Mm-hmm. Like, you can absolutely do this. They're like 6th through 8th level. We've had some character deaths, so mm-hmm. it happens.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's... Yeah, I don't know where that narrative comes from.
I think it's because people want to have something to say that's a little bit like skeptical, which is fair. Like if someone's reviewing a game, they're like, could this be a problem? And it's worth speculating over, mm-hmm. but characters are meant to be able to reach 10th level in Shadow Dark. Like they're meant to be able to do it, you know, based on a lot of data that I calculated out about the game that I built up through playtesting, it should take about a year of maybe once or every other week of play on average. And I've never had a character naturally reach 10th level in one of my own games. Like anytime I was playtesting high level, we actually built high level characters. So the highest character I've ever had in my own home games reached, I believe, 7th level. And so, yeah, it's really weird. Like, it's but you're meant to be able to achieve it, unlike achieving 20th level in 5th edition, which would be next to impossible.
Yeah, nobody gets there.
And the game breaks down well before that. Like, Shadow Dark is meant to not break down and to cleanly take you to 10th level.
That's cool.
Which I hope it does.
By the way, how much have we raised? I just so noticed that somebody anonymously donated $20 to develop Africa. I think it's time we do a vibe check here.
People are asking where the shirt's from too. As Tom intended, this is Bob World Builder's amazing shirt, which was designed with help from Runehammer Games. So it's a combined effort. So go check out Bob World Builder's channel. You can get it through his avenues. And I love it.
Yeah, and go also check out Runehammer's Mainframe podcast. It's really good stuff.
He's putting them on YouTube now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Great stuff. Man, so many commutes on the subway were rendered palatable by that podcast.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
That's funny.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. So, 10th level should be possible. Yeah, 10th level should.
Yeah, everything should be possible if it's in the book.
Can we talk about the absence of saving throws and Thaco, which I've called Thaco my whole life? Saving throws, for somebody who did not grow up in the BX AD&D 2E sphere, are completely incomprehensible. Like, why am I rolling Saver's Breath to dodge this trap? Like,
because it creates a burst of flame like a dragon's breath.
But does it? I mean, not every time. It's just like, I understand why those saves were built up through at-the-table play.
Right.
At you know, Dave's and Gary's tables. Because those were the specific different types of threats they were commonly facing. And it was common enough that they decided to make saves specific to them. But in Shadow Dark, it's not broad enough anymore to cover, you know, like, it is conceptually so much easier, in my opinion, especially for an inexperienced player, to understand that dexterity is the agility dodge type check. And so the five saves are there in spirit, but not in name. They're tied, again, instead to the ability scores that they are most relevant to. And I think that's just a lot easier for people who aren't experienced with old school style play to understand.
Also, just as an aside, what the heck is there a difference between spells and wands for saves in
and
old
magic
school?
Items?
Yeah, like why do I have two different saves for what should effectively be the same thing?
I think that theoretically the reason was because like the enemy wizard was pointing their wand at you versus a global spell effect affecting you, and so they had to hit you. But like it grew out of the fiction of D&D at the table, but it just doesn't make sense anymore. It's not a good umbrella thing, in my opinion. Some people love them, especially because they're nostalgic, and I totally get that. I totally get it. That's not wrong. And Thaco, it wouldn't have been useful because a lot of the unified system in Shadow Dark was a D20 adding a derived bonus from a stat, and to make combat rolls work differently simply for the reason of having Thaco would have been in defiance of that ethos that I've set up. So everything is based on a D20 plus ability score modifier, stat modifier. And I just don't like Thaco. I just don't like it. I'm sorry. It's some people love it, and it's good because you can be like, okay, I hit, but it still requires the dungeon master to tell you the armor class of the monster. So like, I could also just tell you the armor class of the monster and a roll to hit, like a roll high.
Right. I was talking to Professor Dungeon Master at Gen Con last year. We were eating breakfast together, and I don't remember exactly what the professor said, but it was. I was like, that's why Thaco exists. Because, I'm going to make an assumption. So you acid test this for me. Thaco existed because it was obviously arbitrarily confusing. So that you could obfuscate some of the mechanics of hitting monsters from the players because they had to do this like reverse math nonsense or look at a table where it's like, okay, if they've got this armor class and I've got, you know, this Thaco number and so I subtract from 19 and, you know, like you have to use a 4D abacus in order to calculate what number you need to hit. And like I started playing second edition when I was in middle school and, you know, like it took me, like, obviously I didn't know what we were doing. Like, we were just playing at D&D. We weren't actually playing.
Me too.
But, like, it took probably 6 weeks of, like, you know, like, I was a smart kid.
Yeah.
It took 6 weeks of, like, reading and rereading until it finally clicked, like, what was actually going on in Thaco.
Yeah.
You know? So.
I have, like, some theories that agree with that. Like, number one, I think it might have been a little bit of, like, a gamer shibboleth where it's like, can you figure this out?
Do you
get it? Like, can you get it? And, like, if you can, you know, if you can roll, then, like, if you understand how this works, then we'll let you in the door.
That's interesting. So it's, like, a gatekeeping mechanic?
Possibly a little bit. But the other thing, too, is, like, I mean, Thaco does allow for armor classes that are essentially unhittable by low-level characters unless you want to have a natural 20 be an automatic hit, which I can't remember if and when that got implemented. I don't know if that was the case in old...
I don't think it was in second edition.
Yeah. I don't remember. So if anyone in the chat remembers when a nat 20 resulted in an auto hit, let me know. But you, like, a dragon's armor class was simply unhittable by low-level characters. And that's not necessarily true in other D&D-based systems that came out after.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that was also part of it. Like, you literally are stopped at the door. You cannot attack this dragon. There's no way you could hit it. And so that might have been part of it.
Maybe.
Yeah. I mean...
Of course, you could just do that by removing critical hits and hitting over the armor class.
Yeah. Yeah, and, like, I mean, even 5th edition wasn't brave enough to make something unhittable. Like, if you want to fight a... like, of course, an ancient red dragon has a preposterous armor class, but they made...
What was it, like, 36 or something?
I don't know. No, well, in 3rd edition, it was, like, But it's, like, really high. But, I mean, I think that any character... Is it, like, 24?
Yeah, it's 24.
So, like, but a character could hit that.
Yes.
Not that they would try to, but the way the 5th edition addressed that is by creating lesser... like infants, like, you know, like immature dragons, like young dragons and stuff, so that you could still fight dragons.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But in old school D&D, it was like, no, you can't hit that dragon. So I don't know. That was a long Thaco dive.
Yeah.
I just don't like it. I don't like having to reference a chart to know if you hit.
Yeah. That's and silly.
I don't like referencing charts at all in general. Like a lot of like Shadow Dark stuff was designed so that at least the players never have to reference a chart to know whether something was successful.
Except for the mishap table, but that's always fun.
Yes, exactly. That's
it's like, oh, you critically failed the spell cast. Yeah. Now I gotta find out what happens to you.
It is so rare that you actually get to pull it off because like the luck subsystem in Shadow Dark is really meant to help spellcasters in particular avoid mishaps. And it, like... We rarely see a mishap actually happen because of the luck subsystem. So right. I like a lot of people are like, this is a flaw in Shadow Dark because you have a 1% chance of totally killing yourself each time you cast a spell. And that's only true if the entire group has no luck tokens. So
probably is that actually going to
it's
happen?
It's not. It's very rare. It's very rare. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Professor just said, I was there for Thaco. There is no defense for it, needlessly complex.
There it is, we're vindicated, right?
Yes.
I would love to hear people theorizing about why it existed. Referencing charts was like a thing you had to do when you were wargaming, so I think maybe they were just like, it just has to be this way.
Yeah,
you
know? Of course, I'm even seeing like, okay, so, you know, nerd alert here. Mm-hmm. I also like read a lot of historical war games because I don't have friends that are interested in playing them. But I love like the idea of just pulling out some 2mm Napoleonic figures. That just sounds so fun.
Oh, that would be fun.
But like even in those games, modern historicals, mm-hmm. they're starting to get away from mechanics that require charts. Like it's all straight dice at the table. Yes, you have to build out your army, you have to use charts. But once you get playing, the idea is that you should not have more than a sheet of paper to track everything at the table. So, mm-hmm. anyway.
I see someone saying that Thaco is a simplified class-specific attack table from 1E. It is just a number line from negative 10 to 10. Yes, it eliminates the chart.
PDM is wrong.
PDM is wrong. mean, if you memorize, yeah, you can memorize. Or the thing is, most character sheets, even from AD&D, still have a channel for which you write your THACO and whether you can hit, which tells me that it is still a chart reference mentality, whether or not you've actually memorized it. And I think that you could, yeah. And it still requires the Game Master to tell you the armor class. If you want to know whether or not you hit, you will not know until the Game Master tells you. And that's true whether you're using THACO or whether you're using roll to hit with a bonus. So, yeah, that's just my take on it. But someone else is saying there wasn't a... D&D wasn't designed until 3E. I don't agree with that. I don't think that's true.
Yeah, because if it were just a bunch of house rules, we would have gotten Blackmoor on chainmail.
Right. Like, Moldvay took D&D and ran it through an incredibly intense design cleanup.
Yeah.
So, like, I agree that the D&D derived out of a lot of house rules, first and foremost, but mm-hmm. it did go through legitimate design iterations, even earlier than AD&D, during BX.
Yeah. Like, and just to that end, like, I own a physical copy. Thank you very much, Christy, my wife, bought me for Christmas a physical copy of original Dungeons & Dragons white box set, like one of the first 9,000 printed. And I went through it, probably should have been wearing white gloves, but I went through it and, like, it is laughably, terribly laid out and designed. It's clear that that was just the house rules compiled into something that was mostly readable. So to say that that wasn't really designed, that's a rough take.
The art of game design has grown over the last 5 decades,
yeah.
Surely. And, like, there's some agreed upon principles that almost everybody agrees are true now. So I think it was flailingly designed and you know, improved in iteration. So, but yeah, but no, it was designed. It was especially Gary taking Dave's, like, Blackmoor notes and turning it into something semi-usable.
Mm-hmm.
Although I would still not say that OD&D was usable, but, like,
man, is it rough.
It was not.
Wow. I expected on my first read through, I expected to be able to, like, understand, like, I tried to think about it. Like, what was it like to be a new player and sit down with this box set that I just bought at my local war games store for $10,
mm-hmm. you know, oh, yeah.
That's what it costs.
That's a lot of money back then. Yeah.
It's about $55 in today's money. Mm. So, you know, how can I actually play this game? And man, it's hard to do. Something I kind of want to do is, like, you know, mimic Ben Milton from Questing Beast and just say, "Welcome back to Dungeon Masterpiece. I'm Baron. Today we're doing a review of the original Dungeons and Dragons."
It's just
the top down camera on the butcher block table.
And then it's like the, wait, you have to make sure you have a gold wedding ring.
Yeah. I'll take my signet ring off.
The only thing I knew about Ben after, like, watching his, like, page two videos is I was like, he's married. Because it's the only thing I can, because it's just his hands, you know. Bless you, Ben.
Oh, that's funny.
I saw some good questions in here. Gosh, I wish I would not miss them. Someone asked, like, are you afraid? What do you do if you feel like other games are so good that you can't design something because it wouldn't be that good? I totally empathize because I think some games are so, so, so good that it took me a long time to get over the fact that I thought I was contributing, like, not something worthy, you know? Like,
yeah, okay, I have a strong philosophical statement to make about this, or inspirational statement to make about this.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
You may not be able to make the game that is that good now, but you will never learn how to make a good game, or make a comparable game, or make a game that is better than that game if you don't start now. Like, the game that you make will be bad, and that's okay. Just make stuff. Like, rather than being a consumer, be a creator. Make the thing. Mm-hmm. Just go and make the thing. And it's okay if it's bad. It will be a relic of its time. And, you know, you might think to yourself, oh, it takes so long to make a game. And sure, that's true on a certain scale. And I'm not trying to, like, get super into, like, my own personal family life here. But just, this is something that really resonated with me that my step-grandmother said to me once at a dinner table that profoundly reshaped how I think about how long things take. And, you know, I was like 32, 33 at the time.
saying that, you know, I was dating someone, this is when I wasn't married, I was dating some women, I'm not sure if I wanted kids, you know, it's just so much a time investment and so on. And my step-grandmother, who is, I think she just turned 80 this year, she said to me, oh, but your children are only in your life for such a short amount of time. And then they move away and you may not even see them very much anymore. And I was like, oh my God, she's right. But like, I started thinking about it and, you know, I've got a lot of family all over the world. And, you know, it suddenly switched gears in my mind of, I'm only going, like, if I keep on the trajectory of visiting my aunt, I might only see her maybe 15 more times before she passes away, which is a really morbid way to think about it.
No!
Because life ends. But in that time period, like, how much time do we have before you're 80 years old and you die?
Right. That's true. Like, that's true.
We're all going to be playing D&D for another 50 freaking years.
Yeah.
Go make the game.
Yes,
I don't know who you are or how old you are in this virtual setup that we're all here in right now. But no, like, we will be playing D&D for longer than I've been alive already, and I'm almost 40. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like...
Almost 40 club. I agree so, so much. And I could add, like, some small bits of my own philosophy onto that
right.
very insightful thing, which is, that time's going to pass anyway. So what are you going to do with it? Also, the first draft of Shadow Dark sucked. Like, it was awful. Like, the only way that you get something to be good is to keep working at it. And best is also subjective. So the best game for someone else is not the best game for me. If you write a game that is for you and you like every bit of it and it meets all of your needs and goals, then it's your best game. So don't think that you wouldn't contribute something, because as long as you like it, someone else is going to like it. And that's worth doing then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there is also, like, this is something that I've talked about with my Patreon fans in Discord. That there's also just a critical mass of stuff that you need to make before, like, you really start to find your voice and find how to be creative. Like, it's something that you just have to teach yourself to do. And also in that same light, like, if you're sharing your content that you're making, there's also a critical mass of stuff that you have to have before either the algorithms or people in general just organically stumble upon your stuff. And, like, those two things, like, you have to have a codified sense of what your own personal design philosophy truly looks like, and you have to have enough of that created for people to really start finding it and vibing with it, mm-hmm. where they start sharing it out. And it may be, you know, 2-3 years of you making small adventures and getting 1, 2, 3 downloads or something like that. And then all of a sudden, somebody in, you know, in an RPG review society decides to they just bump into your game
mm-hmm.
or bump into your adventure and find it. And it's the one thing that takes off because they said something good about it. Or maybe they said something disparaging about it and everybody wants to go find out why it is. And then they all disagree with this person, right? Like, any number of things could happen, but you have to have that body of work created before that can happen.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, just keep making stuff.
Yes.
Just make stuff.
And also don't look back.
Yeah.
Don't look back. Like, you do your best in the moment on the thing you're working on. It might be that in 5 years you look back and you're like, oh, you know, I'm better now. Like, ooh, I would have changed this or that about it. But, like, don't look back on that. You did the best you could in the moment. You learned something from it. Why go around and around about it? Like, the first adventure I ever published, like, when I go back and look at it, I'm like, huh, I would have done this and that a little differently this time. But, like, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Write a better adventure next time then, you know? So, yeah, we just got really philosophical.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that.
I do too. There's the time you would spend worrying about whether someone would like something, you should spend making things.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And don't design for other people. Just design the thing that you're passionate about.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And other people will find the passion in the thing that you made.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Oh, JP Kuvert is here. Hey, buddy. He says, in my experience, making the thing is more fun than selling it, which is also cool. I agree.
Yeah.
I agree. The joy of creating kind of comes from that state where you're it's like from a flow state, you know, where you're working on something that you care about and you're like making it happen and time's passing. And that's the best part about creating things, I think. Selling it is nice.
I mean, selling puts food on the table.
It does.
That's a cool thing.
And having the end goal of sharing something out will help push you towards that goal, but it's really true that the joy is in the work. And if what you're doing isn't fun, then you should try to change tacks a little bit, because you should try to be having fun for most of it. Some of it's grindy. It's always going to be the case. But most of the time, you should be enjoying what you're doing. I hope.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I just want to take a quick break real quick here and point out that we have raised $259. I saw a whole slew of like donations whiz by in the comments. So thank you all to everybody who donated.
Thank
like,
you.
That's awesome.
Yes.
And I was like, yeah, we'll do $100. So I guess I have to do a feat of strength. Two feats of strength. I don't know what these
what
are.
Would it be?
I have no idea. I have a feeling if I budge this webcam, like it's been on the fritz ever while we were setting this up. So we'll do it at the very end.
Should we arm wrestle? Am I allowed to use both hands and you're only allowed to use one?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. An arm wrestling match where I promise not to throw you through the fireplace.
That would be funny. I think you can squat three of me now is what it is.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah, my one rep max squat is to squat three of your body weight.
Yeah, so that alone is a feat of strength right there.
Yeah.
I don't know what it'll... We'll have to do something at the end or something.
So go Google. This conversation came about because one of my patrons sent me the Meatheads RPG where your only stat is strength. So go check that out. Google it or something. I don't know.
That's the Meatheads RPG.
Yeah.
We were talking... What were we talking about with Jesse where... we wanted to make an RPG about like going into dive bars and the only stat was vibe, and everything you did was based off making a vibe check.
Yeah. Vibe check.
Make a vibe check. Did you pass? All right.
That's you can so actually funny. Get your beer at the bar.
Yeah. So if you fail, like maybe it's like a no but system or like a no and system. I don't know, something. But
I don't know. If you fail the vibe check, then that means some jerk comes up to you and starts cursing you out for like thinking that you were talking to his girlfriend. I don't know.
That was based on the fact that Jesse tries to hang by like throwing out silly made up D&D speak, and she knows it's hysterical, and she'll get to the point where she starts calling for checks and she doesn't know what the stats are, so she'll say make a vibe check.
So good.
Oh man, all right, what have we got?
Do we have any...
Cersa's here. Hey Cersa.
Hi Cersa, how's it going?
Oh my gosh, we have such cool people. Look at all the cool people in the chat here.
I saw Bill from Wylock's Armory. Wylock from Wylock's Armory.
Wylock! Oh,
coming through here.
It's good.
Yeah, and he's close to finishing his cyberpunk RPG, Neon Skies. So go subscribe to his channel so you get a push notification when that comes out.
Oh, that sounds rad.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh my gosh. What else? Oh, a question. What are your opinions on rolling damage without the need to roll to hit?
It's my favorite.
Yeah, you love it. I love it.
I'll never go back.
I know, and I totally like it in the games that it's designed for. It speeds up. It speeds up combat.
Yep.
I liked rolling to hit because again, that goes back to the nostalgia of like the D&D experience for me, where like rolling a critical hit in a dire moment is kind of a very triumphant thing. So at least in Shadow Dark, I mean, I decided to include rolls to hit in Shadow Dark, not for just that reason, but it was one of the reasons. But like, there are a lot of games that have auto damage that are really slick. Like,
oh yeah,
really slick. And like, I know
the whole Into the Odd ecosystem.
Yeah.
Like, and my favorite among those, like Into the Odd is awesome, but it's also a weird, zany game.
Mm-hmm.
So like, don't spring that first on like new players because they're going to be like, what the heck are we actually playing here? But Mouse Ritter and Cairn do that very well.
Yeah. And I know Runehammer's adopting that for Crown and Skull.
Yes,
that's in Crown and Skull, which is like really cool. It's cool. Like it's absolutely an innovation that I think will stick in game design as
for sure.
Like a really useful solution to a problem. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Do we have any other questions?
Not a fan of new rules. That's okay. Yeah. Baron, you won't ever go back. Would you port it to Shadow Dark? I thought about it, but I think it'd break.
No. I'll still play Shadow Dark as written, but no, but, you know, if like I've been talking with a few other, I learned that
I used to call us D&D tubers.
Yeah.
But I bumped into a video where somebody was ranking our...
thumbnails.
Our video thumbnails on a tier list. And I was like, what the heck? The people make the weirdest content. I mean, it's hilarious.
I thought it was really funny.
It was so funny.
I know.
But anyway, the person in this video called us dungeon tubers, which is such a better word.
So, it's a great word.
We are now dungeon tubers.
I love it.
But anyway, why did I bring that up?
I don't know.
I've been talking to a few different dungeon tubers about a sci-fi game I'm making, and it's definitely going to be in the roll damage soak for armor.
But we were blathering about that, and I think you've got some cool angles to try.
Yeah.
I think it's going to be cool.
Hopefully. I don't know.
I love it.
It's currently just in like deep shower thought mode. It's not on paper yet. I think what it needs to do is just start playing. I just need to play it.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, you're kind of at that point. Yeah. You're ready to start testing.
I'm ready to start playing. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
JP asked a question. He said, what adventures do you have in the works? Oh, I'm writing 3 more Cursed Scroll zines, which are like supplemental zines for Shadowdark. And each is going to have an adventure in it. I'm not at the point where I totally know what the adventures will be, but I know kind of the environment that they'll be. And one of them I'm really excited to write is kind of exploring like the whole hinted at jungle vampire thing going on in Shadowdark, like Ob Ix and that named character in the book, and then sort of her empire. It's still out there, and it's in some dark jungle. And so I wanted to write an adventure about that.
Cool
thing in the world. I saw, oh my gosh, Scott's here. Hey Scott. Oh my gosh, Steven's here. Steven, I have to ask you about making Stingbat plushies. You know how to do it.
Yeah,
you know how to do it. I'm gonna ask you when I have a chance. Yep.
Yeah, Steven from Roll for Combat's here, and yes, she does need Stingbat plushies, but also I will send you a link to that dungeon tuber thumbnail tier list.
Yeah. do you think spell levels will be the next sacred cow to potentially get the axe in the gaming sphere, like attack rolls?
100%. Spell levels should die. We should all be moving to Glog spells. Stay tuned for my channel when I release a 5th edition Glog spell conversion
that uses spell points.
You can cast Wish at first level, and if you fail, it's going to be miserable for your character, but you can do it. Actually, that's a lie, but...
I think that there needs to be, like, Vancian spellcasting that's slot-based, that has a really locked-in progression... also, like, levels, just don't call 2 things in the game levels.
That's super confusing.
We know this now.
So I can cast 2nd level spells when I get to 3rd level. I can cast 3rd level spells when I get to 5th level.
Yeah. Like, think back when you first started playing D&D to all the things that confused you. Those are things... That is powerful information to mine when you're writing your own game. But I think like, for me, I love roll to cast because... it removes a lockstep of spell. Like, you could try to cast, like, a 5th-tier spell in Shadowdark, even at 1st level. Generally, if you fail, that's very bad. But, yeah, spell levels are starting to kind of wash away a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, yeah, if you're not familiar with the Goblin Laws of Gaming, go check out that blog. That's where the Glog spells are coming from. That's where I was talking about that.
It's a
fantastic
awesome.
Idea.
We have all these acronyms that we just throw out there.
I know. And then I'm like, wait a minute, most people probably don't know what this context is.
I know. Yes, means basic expert D&D, like the introductory type of D&D that was developed after OD&D while AD&D was being advanced Dungeons & Dragons. First edition was being developed.
Anyone and then don't forget about Beckme.
right. And then, like, the different iterations of BX and, like, all of its different, like, the Cook versus Moldvay and Menser. And it's, I don't know if the nuance is worth knowing unless you like D&D history, but there's all of that.
It's all basically the same game.
Yeah. There was a cool question. Okay, did you, hoping to get physical copy? Oh, yeah, anything that I have in physical print, besides, like, the premium edition of Shadowdark, I'm going to be... reordering print runs of as needed, as long as there's interest in them. So yes, Shadowdark books are actually going to be for sale, like, probably by the end of the month on my website.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, so soon. Really soon. How did you come up with giving the monsters one simple ability? Oh, thanks. I think it's brilliant and fun to figure out what each monster... Thank you. That came from... the fact that I like monsters having unique abilities. Like, I think that in, like, basic expert D&D, there are a lot of monsters that were just a stat line. And that's fine, but you can add a little more nuance to them, which we saw expand huge, like we saw this like huge expansion of monster abilities in third edition and then an eventual condensing down towards fifth edition of that feature. And so I wanted each monster to have an ability that was very reflective of its like prime quality, like its most notable quality. And that involved like cutting down a lot of stuff too. Like if you look at an Aboleth in Shadowdark and you look at an Aboleth in 5th edition D&D, you can see that I cut some of the Aboleth's features, but not any that anyone cared about, I don't think. I kept its primary ones. So giving monsters a little bit of unique flavor is totally worth it in my opinion. But there's very easily a way to go overboard on that, and so you gotta keep it reined in. Mm-hmm. If the monster's too complicated to run without reading it like twice, it's too complicated.
Yeah.
Because it's gonna die soon anyway. it's walking on and walking off, so like being so complicated is almost never worth it. Oh, hi, Kelsey. Could you talk about your approach to class design in Shadowdark? Oh, that's really nice. I wanted class design to be one of the easiest and most fun things to do in the game, because I wanted, like, especially like the third party to make a ton of classes, or make classes for your home game, or classes just for your world, or for this adventure. And the real theory behind it is that each class is supposed to not necessarily be perfectly balanced against the other classes. I feel like that's a sacred cow. Instead, each class should be the best at what its chosen feature is. So fighters are the best at swinging weapons. Priests are the best at healing people. Thieves are the best at exploration-based skills. Pit fighters are the best at not dying. Witches are the best at controlling magic. I think that niche protection is more important than balance.
And I would agree with that.
Yeah. And that's the philosophy behind classes. And then keep them simple. Only give them a few things. Give them stuff that scales with their level if you can. And if they don't have that, then give them some good stuff at first level so that they stay relevant as the other classes around them are scaling. That's it.
Yeah. The assassin class you made is super fun. It's probably the most complex class I think you've
made. One of them, yeah.
Yeah, because it has like two leveling tables.
Yeah.
Where you level up and get an ability, or you eat a black lotus petal.
Yeah.
TM.
Yeah. Is it? Yeah, I know. Wizard of the Coast made me do that. That's funny. The Razgodai, that's what the assassin class is called. It's in Cursed Scroll 2. Those came out of an adventure I wrote for 5th edition, and someone in my Discord server recently noticed that all of my 5th edition material has world continuity with all of my Shadowdark material.
Oh, that I didn't notice that.
They
that's
reference
cool.
each other sometimes.
Oh, that's awesome.
And it's because I'm writing from my own home game world when I'm writing this material, regardless of system.
Okay, so I gotta ask you this.
Mm-hmm.
Your game world.
Mm-hmm.
Because this blows my mind. People who make a single game world. You've made one game world. How long have you been playing in this game world?
It's grown every time I run a session in it, because it started as nothing. And like it's been a completely, it's a self-expanding game world that either fits the need of an adventure that I want to write or a place that my players are going. So it's just grown over time. It's not even fully coherently mapped.
Hmm.
But that's so for 10 years.
Really?
Yeah.
Man, that's so interesting to me. Because I view game worlds as just so disposable.
Yes.
But like I'll play a 6-month campaign and ball up all the paper from it and throw it in the trash mm-hmm. and start completely over again and never reference the other part of that. No, never reference the other thing.
You don't have to, right? You don't have to reference the other thing. You could have a part of your game world that's totally isolated from the others and retroactively justify why it's still part of your game world.
Maybe. Like, I don't know. It's never something that I've... I guess I'm just asking, like, it's never something I've considered as something that I should or could or would do, or that other people do in fact do.
Mm-hmm.
But then I start like poking around on the internet, and I feel like at least the people, so maybe it's a hyper reality problem, the people who are talking about this online, they're the ones who are like making this expansive game world that goes on and on forever.
Mm-hmm.
And like, whether they're, you know, armchair D&D players or actual D&D players,
mm-hmm.
like, the experience is the same? I don't know. Chat, tell us.
Yeah.
Am I crazy?
Right. I don't know if PDM is still in the chat. I don't know if he had to go, but he's been running a game for his players, some of whom have been playing in the same game for, like, 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
Is it all the same world? like, or mostly the same world. I know that PDM has taken dips into different genres and stuff with the same group. But, right. like, when he's playing classical fantasy, is it all the same world? I don't know. I bet. Maybe. And then the other thing about it is, like, it for me, this only works if I only expand the world when I need to.
Hmm.
Like, I don't sit down and start world designing. Like, world designing responds to the needs of what I'm writing or what my players are doing. And, like, it only is expanded out that far. So that keeps it manageable, and mm-hmm. and it makes it easier to cross-reference between things, because it's not like the Forgotten Realms where, like, you accidentally, like, you talk to one person in this town and it turns out they're, like, the cousin of that person who's actually the king of that realm or whatever. Like, that's not that hyper-connected.
Mm,
and it can't okay. be, or else it would become cumbersome.
Right.
Yeah. There's yeah. a few named characters who are present throughout. Very few. Very, very few.
Right.
Like Drusilla, if anyone knows who I'm referencing with that, in Curse Scroll 1. I also wrote an adventure that she's in. Manazusa, who's a enemy that is the leader of the Razgodai. Maybe an enemy. A few yeah. people. Just okay. a few people.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Wylock, thanks for donating again.
Hey, thank you.
See, Dungeoncraft, it's the same world since 1993. I designed the same way. How old was I in 1993? Let me think about that for a second. Where's my...
I was in grade school.
Was I in kindergarten? No, I was in kindergarten in 91. Hold on. I graduated in 2004.
I was in first grade.
You were in first grade?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was 11. I was... Yeah, 90... That was... I had been playing D&D for 1 year.
Aw, I started around 11 as well. I think yeah. I was 11 or 12 when I started okay. playing. Yeah, so you were a little bit ahead of me, but... Shoot. So PDM's been running the longest continuous game world ever and says... And he says he only plans one session ahead. I know that Hank from Runehammer really only plans one session ahead. Like, truly. And it...
That also is mind-blowing
to me. It is. And in particular... One thing I really like about his work, like if you guys have read his Worlds book for Index Card RPG, or you just look through Master Edition or anything, or even across game systems that he designs, there is world continuity between a lot of them. Like, oh, it's crazy. Interesting. Yeah.
Okay.
And because I think he also uses this expand as needed, and he also allows his players in his home games to impact the canon of his game world.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, I've gotten to do that once or twice, playing a game with them.
That's cool.
Yeah, and it's really cool. It's really, really amazing to, as a player, to know that your actions are impacting the game world in such a way. It's special.
Hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
That also is really mind-boggling to me, because, like, I'll plan out enough meat so that I have surface for gameplay
mm-hmm.
for probably 6 months' worth of content.
Yeah.
Like, I don't plan out, like... what is happening in the next session. Like, that is also weirdly foreign to me.
Mm-hmm,
I'm like, I need enough to where I can very easily react to whatever the hell the players want to do.
Yeah.
In any given direction. Like, if they're just in the middle of a dungeon and decide, let's go clear across the map. Cool. I got you, fam.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, you know.
Mm-hmm. That's, you, see, I've always wondered how you approach this. Because you have a lot of knowledge about geopolitical things and geopolitics.
Yeah.
And so, like, you have a way of looking at a game world. Like, by the way, Farron analysis. You did an amazing video that's, like, totally a huge hit.
Yeah.
Analyzing.
Larian Studios shared the video. I found out.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And, like, it's been getting a huge surge in views because of Baldur's Gate.
Yeah.
And stuff explaining Farron. And, like, you have a holistic way of looking at a map and a mm-hmm. game world and seeing how they all impact each other. I don't think many people have that level of knowledge about it.
Sure. So, like, yeah. No, I totally recognize that.
Yeah. Which yeah. is cool. It's really cool because I feel like you have a way of designing outside in,
right.
whereas I have to design inside out. And if, like,
right.
my if I ever tried to put my game world into a coherent map, it would probably completely fail the sniff test for being realistic.
I don't know. I'm not sure of that. It's a fantasy world. It's right. all unrealistic.
Right. But, like, geographically speaking, yeah, like, yeah. it wouldn't be as coherent as, like, a world that was set up understanding, like, the way the climate impacts the regions.
I think when you start getting into stuff like that, like, yes, it can add value, but it also is a little pedantic.
Like
rivers can flow uphill in a fantasy world. Like, let's be honest here.
Yeah.
Like, those kinds of things can be informative of your game design, but mm-hmm. like, I think, I don't know, there's a lot of technique for geopolitical strategy that I do apply to world building.
that, and this is something that I tried to record a talk, but the recording failed at Mythicon. But I just got approved to give the same talk at Gen Con this year. This year, I will be at Gen Con doing a 1 hour long masterclass on geopolitical world building. So come to that if you're going to be at Gen Con.
Oh my gosh, come to Gen Con. We're all going to be there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, like, I'll show you how, like, one lazy Saturday's worth of prep will give you an entire year's worth of content, basically, with no more than 10 minutes of prep between sessions. Wow. Like, that's the goal.
Wow.
So, like, it is really interesting to me when I hear people say, I only prep for the next session. Because I'm like, it breaks my brain. I want to understand how people do that and it not just feel like a completely noodly spaghetti world.
People, you know what's funny is people say that they only prep for the next session, but they are doing that in the context of what they know is the world backdrop. You have to know a little bit about what's going on in your world at large, because it would be very blinders on to only be making the next session without at least some surrounding possible paths and stuff. So it is misleading when people say they only do one adventure prep, because they're doing that in the context of knowing enough about the world around where the players are.
Right.
Yeah. So there's a balance. But I would love to hear like a video of yours. Like, I know you're going to give a talk on it, but I also
I want to record it so that I can put it online.
Yeah.
I could do it like on a live stream or as a recording, but and do it with the chat. But having like the dialogue of the audience, I think, is really useful for that kind of talk.
Yeah.
I don't know.
What about like a top five mistakes about geopolitical setup that people make when designing their game world? Like you noticed some in the Faerun video.
Yeah.
It's worth watching because you notice, like, why is this city not the richest city on the map?
Right. Like, it should be the richest city.
Yeah.
But maybe, like, I was also just riffing off the map. So, like, maybe there's an in-lore reason why it's not. You know, I don't know.
Maybe.
I don't know. So... Mm-hmm. I don't even like calling them necessarily mistakes. I think it's just a good idea to like recognize that maybe in a normal, mundane world, this is the way it would be.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes if you go really fantastical, and you see this a lot with sci-fi, especially people who don't write hard sci-fi, that like the technology gets away from their understanding of like thinking through the knock-on ripple effects of like how society would react to this technology existing. And you know, it sounds a little silly, but like the concept of colonialism and mercantilism was only made possible because of gunpowder and the galleon sail rigging. Like those two advancements in technology suddenly changed the geopolitical zeitgeist of the world for nearly 400 years.
Wow.
You know, like that became the new status quo until finally the Industrial Revolution started happening.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I still think like we're in the middle. We're probably at the end of the Industrial Revolution now. But you know, it's still ongoing. Like, ask any historian about, I'm getting really noodly here. Ask any historian about like, are we still in the agricultural revolution? Probably, you know, it's not like this, you know, finite thing that happened. It just changes course over time. So just like recognizing that they're like, people have resources and people are scared to lose them.
Mm-hmm.
And just think through what each faction's resources are and how they would react with the tools they have at hand to losing the resources they have at hand. That's basically the gist of what this kind of strategy is for world building.
I love that you acknowledge, or that you're the first person to say that you can get too noodly with this stuff. Because like, it is easy to like think that world building is just an exercise in reflecting the real world. And
it's not.
Right. But having some of the knowledge that you have could allow you to set up really interesting like conflicts or things that make the world kind of come to life that might have been outside of our normal consideration which is really cool. It's just another tool to make the world more interesting.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. As long as but you don't want to go overboard in any regard on any type of world building front.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just basically the lesson is people are scared to lose their stuff.
Yeah.
So think about how they would react when they lose their stuff given the tools that they have to protect it. That's basically it.
That's even true on a micro level in a dungeon.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, for sure. Yeah. Absolutely. That, like, you can do that kind of analysis inside of a mega dungeon or in a 25-room dungeon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. A baron plays Civ once. You've played it more than once! Yeah. what else have we got? Advice from an improv GM. Let the players find out why it's not the richest city. Yeah, Doc.
That's, yeah, yeah, absolutely.
That's true. Like, it'd be fun to come up with an explanation for why that is, and having that knowledge... Again, it creates an adventure hook right there.
For sure.
Like, you wouldn't have even thought of it. Like, oh, wait, this should have been the richest city, but it's not. Why? Well, now you have a cool thing to rip on. Yeah. Right.
Like, Argentina, that should be the richest continent, or richest nation in the world, in my opinion. But, you know, neither here nor there.
There have been problems.
Yeah.
There have been roadblocks. Yeah. Oh, my gosh. I'm looking through and see if we had any other outstanding questions.
Yeah, we've been going for like an hour and a half.
Oh, my gosh. We've been really
How much money have we raised? Somebody in the chat tell me. I'm going to look on the phone. It's a race now.
It's a race. Oh, my gosh. I like that.
We have 185 people in the chat. There's so many people in this room.
People are like, how did Baron and Kelsey get in the same room? Well, I saw him wandering around outside and I felt bad and I was like, do you need shelter? And so I was like, okay.
I was just lost in the ether of the internet saying,
yeah,
is anyone here?
Oh man. Oh, Scott's here too. Hello from Argentina. Hi, Santiago. Hello. Caesar, they beat me to it. Wow, I'm amazed. We had such a like amazing audience for this too. Like, so many cool people have been showing up and really good questions. Thank you for your donation to Develop Africa. Someone anonymously did
anonymously, that. Which just pushed us over 300.
Oh no! What can be a feat of strength that you could do?
Three? I don't know. I have no. I was really just talking out of my rear. But.
I know. We can talk hypothetically about the feats of strength we think you could do.
Okay.
If you held your arm straight out, could I hang off of it like a monkey bar?
Absolutely not. Okay. No way.
That would be too hard. Yeah. I don't know anything about
lifting weights. Holy cow. There's no way. No pointed
reference for strength training. None.
I might be able to do a third of you.
On a lift? On a lift?
Yeah, with a lateral. I might be able to do what do you weigh, like 100 pounds? Yeah. I might be able to do 35 pounds.
So I would have to,
and that would be hard.
I would have to be in the shape of like a barbell bar in order to be liftable in a conventional manner.
Yeah, if you were to sit on my shoulders, I could do probably, I would say 30 squats.
I could drag you all the way down the block.
Before it would be more of an endurance test than anything. It's like, how many could I actually do?
Oh, man.
This is ridiculous. We're not going to do this.
No, we can't do feats of strength. It's too dangerous. Do you see this fire right here?
It's so hot. It's so hot.
Not necessarily a question about Shadow Dark, but what are your favorite mega dungeons? Ooh. Okay, I think I have a maybe controversial opinion on this. I believe that Caverns of Thracia is a mega dungeon, and therefore it is my favorite one.
I agree with you.
Barely a mega dungeon.
I think that a mega dungeon is anything larger than 25 rooms.
Okay.
Like, I think the definition of a mega dungeon is way too strong. Like, the flagpole has been planted at far too high a number to where, like, how many people actually go through the entirety of Caverns of Thracia and see every room?
Not one. Yeah.
Most players go through it and never even see half.
Isn't it?
So,
yeah, it's so
and it's only like what, 70 something rooms? If that?
It gets high. It gets up there. Like, yeah. I think, like, conventionally speaking, it gets up into the hundreds. But there are whole subsections of the dungeon that you can utterly bypass and miss. And even
completely
like,
bypass.
And there's some of the coolest parts of the dungeon, too. But, like, do you know the amount of restraint it must have taken to write, like, some of the coolest material in the dungeon and just know that your character, your players might not see it?
Yeah.
That takes a lot of restraint.
I think what's really fascinating to me is, and this is something, I've talked about this with Leif from Devs and Dice. So if you're into, like, terrain building, he's got a great, I mean, Wylock's in the chat right now. Go check out his channel. But also, Leif from Devs and Dice does fantastic Warhammer terrain. But he is a video game developer by trade. And I got to talking to him about level design in video games. And I was like, why is it exactly that nobody makes like really expansive mega dungeons that you can easily get lost in? Like, even Skyrim
in its largest dungeon that takes you down to the mushroom forest underneath a dwarven city, you could be delving this dungeon for 2.5-3 hours of gameplay, but you're gonna see every bit of it because it's almost an entirely linear path. Mm. And Leif just hit it right on the nail head. Why would the management team want developers making parts of a game that they're not sure? Like, it's okay to have an Easter egg, but why would you make huge parts of the game that you're not sure the players are ever going to see?
That's so inefficient. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like a total waste of economic resource to do this. But in the context of a tabletop RPG, you're not spending a whole, like, the amount of effort that it takes to make an Easter egg as like an off secret room in a video game level is about as much time as it takes to make 40 damn rooms in a mega dungeon.
Yeah.
You know?
It's, wow, that's so true. I feel like one of the beautiful things about tabletop gaming is that it can operate outside of those restrictions very easily. Mm-hmm. You know, like, it just is what it is. It takes less effort to make a dungeon for a role-playing game than it does to make a whole video game level. Right. So, yeah.
But it is interesting, like, the other cost is, like, the emotional grief of, like, should you keep the secret doors from your players? Like, it's a weird philosophical question.
Why would you design
all this cool content and not show it to your players?
So one of the flaws of Thracia is that, in my opinion, the secret doors are too hard to find.
No, I agree.
And that, because, I mean, like, Janelle was creating an entire category of dungeon for the first time in history in designing this. So, of course, there are going to be things that we have maybe now come to agree or could have been done slightly differently. But, having a secret door is good as long as there's enough of a tell that it's worth looking there.
Like, there should be some sort of telegraph.
Yeah.
Even if it's on completely on the other side of the dungeon.
Yes.
Like, finding a wizard's old notebook saying, I went through the secret door by, you know, the dragon statue.
Yeah.
Oh, crap, now we need to go be looking for the secret door.
Yeah.
We need to go back there, you know?
Because what it ultimately is a reward for the players.
Yes.
For smart play. So, you, like, there's a balance between making it too hard to find and not, you know?
Right.
So I would err on the side of easier to find.
And also, Inside of Dice, thank you very much for the riffing of says the guy who couldn't make a 365-room dungeon in 10 hours.
That is so close! We got so close! It was, you know what? It was impressive. Breaking 300 rooms, impressive.
Yeah.
Yeah. You were the one who almost died from that.
No. Okay, so a lot of people don't know this from the live stream. If you're not familiar, I did a live stream, it was New Year's Eve.
Three weeks ago. Yeah.
To design a 365-room mega dungeon, one room for... It was basically the Dungeon 23 Challenge issued by Sean McCoy, if you're familiar with that. Mm-hmm. 365-room dungeon. The original goal was one room every day. Like, you would wake up in the morning as a ritual while you're drinking your coffee and add a room to the dungeon. Mm-hmm. I said, screw this, I'm going to do it all in one day, and I'm going to do it in 10 hours. I didn't finish, and I streamed for 12. I did not eat enough that day, and after the live stream was over, I stood up, and my knees nearly buckled out from underneath me. I did not realize how lightheaded I was. I did not realize how little I had eaten. Like, I had a quarter of a bag of popcorn, a breakfast burrito, and some veggies and dip, and that was it. I don't think I got more than 600 calories that day.
Because I came into the stream late because I was totally caught up in doing Kickstarter-related work. And you looked like a sled dog in the last 10 miles of the Iditarod. Like, you were so tired. And, like, you had this, like, sort of, like, I'm gonna get it done, like,
energy. Yeah, it was just pure grit, like, going on at that point.
I could tell you were experiencing physical pain, like, while you were writing. I was like, we got to rally. And you see, people from my Discord server, like, showed up and helped, and it was so cool. Like, I feel like there was a lot of waves of support that came throughout the day.
It was
that
really
It was really one of the coolest, like, of live streamed events I've ever seen.
Yeah. No, 100%. I think what's interesting, like, don't even go watch that live stream. Go watch Indestructo Boy's review of the live stream. He was part of the challenge. I had a bunch of different YouTubers, dungeon tubers, come on the show with me. But it was so fun to hear what he was saying about that. So go check that out.
He did an excellent recap, and he really captured my feelings about it too. Where it just felt like this really joyful, collaborative, exciting, fun, playful thing, and that's what you hope to get out of this 100%. Kind of like. Yeah. That's why we do this stuff.
Yeah,
you know,
it's fun. Yeah. It's fun to just hang out and. Do
nerd
this
out about stuff. Yeah. Like, heck, I that's practically something that if we had all been sitting in the same room together, we would have done anyway. Right. Like, yeah.
Runehammer just asked if this fire is CG.
Is it CG?
No, it's a, what is it, the fabric that ripples? I don't know. I actually
don't know what it is. It's like somehow it's like a screen. Light. It's not real fire.
It doesn't even put off heat.
It can, but it's not. Oh, it's not. It can. It wouldn't be fire-based heat. It would be electricity-based heat. Man, I missed a few good questions up back.
Do we want to scroll up?
Can
here?
We? Because there was some really good questions,
yeah,
and they slipped my mind.
Go ahead and scroll up there if you want. It's weird to do it on my phone.
Scroll up or down here.
There we go.
How can we play games like
300 push-ups? Oh, jeez. I'm not sure I can do 300 push-ups. I think the most push-ups I can do right now is like 60.
Ooh, here's a really great question from Paladin Pros, who makes great videos.
Yeah, go check out Paladin Pros. He's got some fun videos.
Yeah.
Smaller channel, too, so help him blow up.
Some of these are related, so maybe we can merge them. How can we play games like Shadow Dark or other rules-like games? Okay, I'll sit back by the mic. How can we play games like Shadow Dark or other rules-like games but make them more heroic? That's a great question.
Okay.
Shadow Dark has some modes of play, which Paladin mentioned, that try to help with this, but if you really want to look at why those modes exist, what they're trying to do, it's expanding action economy, giving players the ability to do more than one action on their turn in limited situations, because if you do that all the time, the game's going to slow down. And increasing survivability a little bit, maybe, like... the ability to, but really, in my opinion, the number one thing that makes the game feel more heroic is increasing the action economy. For the players only, not the monsters.
Really?
Yeah, because then it allows them to basically double their effectiveness as a character. And and effectiveness is what creates heroicness, you know? So, like, Indiana Jones is a prime example of that. Like, if he weren't effective, he wouldn't be heroic.
Hmm, okay.
So that's my take on it. I think that that's the number one way to make something feel more heroic. And then, of course, with Shadow, you may want to increase hit points just a little bit, but I don't think you would necessarily need to.
Okay.
I think that's just a safety valve.
I think it's interesting you say that, because I thought that your pulp style play, where you start the game with multiple luck tokens.
That is the heroic mode.
Oh, okay.
That is the heroic mode, actually.
Okay,
yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah,
which, like, gotcha. I was like, wait a minute. Yeah. We're talking about different things here.
No,
okay.
I was calling it pulp mode, but like pulp mode to me is like, I think of both Conan and actually Indiana Jones. So,
okay.
Yeah, and that's like allowing you to expend luck tokens normally as you would, or to get more actions, or to like maximize damage or things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Critical, turn hits into critical hits and stuff, so... Yeah, that I think it's not too hard to make something heroic using those methods. Yeah.
Cool.
Now, the people were asking, like, how can we get people to try games that aren't 5e?
Tell them that you're playing 5e. And if they don't like it, they can leave. It's that easy.
Bring it on.
It's that. I'm tired of this. How do I get... Like, I'm not trying to razz the chat here. Like, thank you for the question. But just put your foot down, man. Just put your foot down. And if they don't want to play because they're so obsessed with playing 5e, that's fine. But...
We're just tough loving you by saying that. Because, like, it's funny. Because people ask that a lot. People do ask that a lot, although... You know, it's a fair question to ask, because if you love a game and you want to try it, you like, it feels like you don't want to sour your players on it, you know?
Yeah.
And so,
part of it is like, get the quick start rules. They're free. That'll take you through what, third level?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like, go do that, convert them that way. And if they still don't want to play, go get new friends. Like, seriously, if they are so married to fifth edition that they can't respect you as their friend and as their dungeon master, who's clearly putting in the most work to the game. Like, if they can't respect that enough of your friendship and the amount of labor you're doing to make them play that they can't adjust, to learn a new rule set that is exceptionally easy to learn. And I think that is part of the problem, is that 5th edition is a difficult system to learn, and that once they've learned it, there's a lot of emotional connection to learning a system that is negatively related. Mm-hmm. So, you know, do it with the quick start rules, show them that the booklet is super tiny, you know, if you really want to hold their hand into it. But gosh, just go get new friends and who have no concept of what playing D&D is like. Just drop the quick start rules in front of them. Hey, these are the simple rules that we're going to play for a game like D&D. It's kind of based on it. It's almost like it. This is what we're doing. Now we're playing Shadow Dark. I don't know.
I agree.
I'm a little sociopathic about it because D&D is more important than friends. Okay, that's not true. D&D friends are more important than friends.
Maybe they're not mutually exclusive. You know, like, yeah, they shouldn't be mutually exclusive. You need one to have the other generally. But I agree. I think that, like, if you want your players to like a new system and they're very tied to D&D as a brand, I get it, because I've been there too. Like, D&D as the brand is what convinced me to play 4th edition. I won't comment further. I think
I wasn't saying anything.
I couldn't disguise my vague dislike. No, I played a lot of 4th edition, tons of stuff I liked about it, but it's the edition that I probably least wanted to continue playing, you know? And anyway, like, D&D as a brand is very powerful, and there's a fallacy of sunk cost into, you know, the notion that because you've invested so much in something, it is therefore more valuable and that you can't walk away from it. And so I think that knowing that that players kind of subconsciously suffer from those beliefs kind of helps you pitch new games to them, being like, hey, this is old school D&D. You can say that. You could say that about Cairn or Shadow Dark. You could say that about ICRPG. You could say that about Deathbringer. Like, it is old school D&D at its core, so it's not unfair to label it that way. And I think that that's a way to convince brand lovers over to trying new games. And the other thing is, like, put on your tux and give them the best show they've ever had that night. Like, really try to sell it. Like, invest the effort in making something cool. Make a really fun session. Like, you know, put its best foot forward and run a one-shot of it. And then maybe it'll stick.
And another one is, don't forget my step-grandmother's words of wisdom. You're going to live until you're 80.
What's up?
Based on my YouTube demographic information, that means that most of you are 28 to 34 years old. That means there's still a long time that you can go back and play 5th edition if you really want to. So there's nothing wrong with trying Shadow Dark, mm-hmm. You know?
And recall that Wizards of the Coast has dropped the prior edition of D&D like a hot bag of rocks and have suddenly branded it as not D&D. Like, have you noticed this? Like, the prior editions of D&D are disallowed from carrying the weight of the D&D brand in the way that they pitch things. It's almost like they're scorned now. Like, they used to be the thing of the moment. They used to be the brand, and now they're just thrown out and kicked into the gutter. So, like, the idea of what D&D is, even to Wizards of the Coast, changes all the time.
That's an interesting point that I hadn't thought of. That is true.
They've completely abandoned, like, yeah, basic expert D&D. Yeah. They're like, that's not real D&D. You know, and and it is. It's, like, one of the most real D&Ds there is, you know? So,
absolutely. Yeah. It is D&D.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. The disowned editions, someone said.
The disowned
editions. Kiwi said that, the disowned editions. It's true.
That's so funny.
Yeah, so just remember that the brand itself is not just only the current edition of the game. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What else?
Do we have any other questions? We've been going for almost 2 hours.
What systems do you think simulationist rules work best for versus where abstraction works best? Okay, so my favorite simulationist on the planet is Trevor Duvall. He loves simulation-style games, and he's kind of like the champion of simulationist-style games because I think more people are less preferential toward it. And he loves Harn, and it has.
I've never played Harn.
Me neither.
I don't even think I've read it.
Can we get him to run it for us?
Yes. Trevor, are you in the chat?
Please,
come
run
play
it
with
us.
Harn for us.
I want it because it's got a lot of really fun simulationism to it. And I had a long chat with him once about it, where he kind of persuaded me that you actually can extract a lot of creativity out of the nuanced role tables and stuff because it takes you away from your cliches. It forces you to come up with results that you would have never anticipated, and it really does actually boost creativity in a lot of ways. So I think simulationist games like Harn have a lot of merit and are worth scoping out and are highly regarded by people who love simulationist games. And we should try it sometime.
Okay.
Yeah.
And now, you just off of that, just because Trevor likes it, I'm going to download it and rate it now.
He says it's a hard one to just enter. Like, it's hard to get through the gate of the game. It's difficult to absorb and implement, but that he finds it well worth it.
Okay. So, cool. Yeah,
a fun intellectual exercise.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Not a fan of Shadow Dark's bard. That's okay, Marcus Aurelius. I'm not a fan of your philosophy. No, I think Stoicism is just fine. It's so just funny. Marcus Aurelius. Stoicism is useful when you have to deal with misery.
Mm.
If your default is misery, Stoicism is the philosophy for you.
Oh, that's...
Is that harsh?
I need to not respond to that. On that note...
I'm totally razzing you, Marcus. It's okay if you don't like the bard. It's not a core class. It's okay. There's classes that people don't like, even within a game that they like. I'm just joking. Just joking.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, do we want to wrap it up here? We've been going for about 2 hours. Do we have any last minute questions?
I'm checking our chat.
Yep.
The table and dart. I think that's a good stopping point.
Okay.
Because we covered a ton.
We've talked about a lot of stuff.
I totally poked fun at the philosophy of Stoicism. And no, it's okay. You've opened the door
for me to start talking about that, which means I need to sign off.
Oh, no. Somebody who actually knows what he's talking about. We got to leave now.
Way too much political philosophy.
I don't know anything about it. I know nothing.
It's all useless. That's all you need to know.
Oh, no.
All right.
Okay. Well,
thanks for joining us, everybody. Go check out the Arcane Library on YouTube and check out Shadow Dark at thearcanelibrary.com. And also, if you want to support making more content like this in the future, please consider supporting me and Kelsey Dion on Patreon. Well, you don't have a Patreon.
No, so but you could buy my stuff if you want.
Buy her stuff. Anyway, thanks for joining us, everybody. Good night.
Thank you.
There we go.
I was mean to Marcus Aurelius.